Okay, so actually, I started nicely. My talk is going to build off a lot of what's already been discussed. I want to begin with a question of what is capitalism? And I think capitalism is often just taken as equivalent to markets. So when we think about capitalism, we think about people trading goods and services, or even a more sort of sophisticated way, we look at Phil's work and sort of think about the diversity of markets and the way in which capitalism perhaps brings them together. But I think capitalism is actually something different than just a market, and I think Marx's work really points to exactly why that's the case. Now, I think the value of Marx's work lies partly in its systemic analysis of capitalism, not simply as an economic system, but also as a social system. So I think seeing capitalism as a social system distinguishes it already from a lot of orthodox economics today. But the systematic focus of Marx's work also means that it's different from a lot of other critical political approaches. So Marxism isn't trying to offer a sort of piecemeal critique of things that have gone wrong within capitalism. Instead, it's trying to say that this is a systemic totality that operates and coordinates a bunch of different elements together. So it involves a series of presuppositions and posited conditions that enable capitalism as a socio-economic totality to function. Now, I think this is important for today because if we want to think about political strategy, if we want to think about what should we be doing today, we need to have some sense of the enemy. We need to have some understanding of the systematic nature of capitalism. And if it's approached as a totality, this means that some nodes, some elements of capitalism, are more significant than others. And certain aspects of capitalism are going to be more susceptible to transformation than others. And I think we can only get this if we look at it as a totality. So what is capitalism then, and how do markets precisely fit in? Now, I think we can begin by looking at one of the key features of the capitalist mode of production, which is its unique success at raising productivity levels. This is why, with a few amount of workers, we can produce much more food than we ever did hundreds of years ago. This is because we've increased the productivity. We've introduced new technologies, which allowed us to basically use fewer people, but produce more at the same time. So this is the key dynamic that expresses capitalist economies' unprecedented capacity to grow at a rapid pace and to raise living standards. This is why capitalism has enabled us to actually raise our living standards over the past hundred years, or a few hundred years. But what makes capitalism so productive, especially compared to other modes of production? Why is it so productive? Now, one argument might be that simply, collectively, at one point in time, one point in history, we all decided, well, we're going to be more productive. We just haven't been working all that hard, and suddenly we're going to start working much harder. Now, that seems pretty implausible. And what Marx tries to argue is that it's not a psychological mechanism which changes and introduces this new productive aspect. Instead, it's a change in social relations. So it's particularly property relationships which change and bring about this turn towards a much more productive mode of production. So in pre-capitalist societies, for instance, producers had direct access to their means of subsistence, most notably land for farming and for housing. So you had common pieces of land that people could use to grow their own crops, build their own houses. It wasn't something that was separated away from you. Now, under those conditions, survival did not systematically depend on how efficient your production process was. So the vagaries of natural cycles, so say, for instance, you have a drought one year, you don't get as many crops, that might limit your capacity for survival, but that was a contingent accident rather than something systematic to that mode of production. So the constraints on survival have to do with that rather than anything systematic. And basically, you could just work sufficiently hard to gain the resources which are necessary for survival. And at that point, you could quit your day, stop working, and go on doing whatever else you wanted to do. Now, under capitalism, this changes. Economic agents are now separated from their means of subsistence. They no longer have access to the land. So workers suddenly are forced to go out and find a job. They have to sell their labor power in the labor market. So a whole series of sort of laws had to be put in place. People had to be forced off the land. Enclosures movements to turn these things into private property. All sorts of efforts to force people into being proletarians, to force people into being workers for capitalism. Now, consumers, in order to secure any sort of goods that they might need for survival, couldn't go to the land because they'd been tossed off the land. Instead, they had to turn to the market. So they had to rely upon the market now for their survival. Now, likewise with capitalists, if you own a production process, suddenly, in order to make any revenues, you had to go to the market to sell your goods. So you were dependent upon the market in order to survive as a capitalist or as a worker. So under these circumstances, economic agents were uniquely faced with generalized market dependency. So this allows us to understand that markets have long existed before capitalism. Markets could exist after capitalism, but what's unique to this mode of production is the fact that markets take on this generalized element and that we become dependent upon them for our survival. That change in the social relationship is what drives the productivity. So production suddenly becomes oriented towards the market. If you're a capitalist and if you want to make a decent revenue, you have to sell your goods on the market, but you've also got other capitalists that are competing on that same market. So this drives down prices. People are constantly trying to sell their goods in the market. It drives down prices. And this means that we start to see the sort of convergence of production costs in relationship to prices. Now this imperative, this competitive aspect built upon the social relationship is the source of many of capitalism's core features. So it's behind the adoption of efficient technologies and techniques in the labor process. If introducing a new series of technologies, say the assembly line, say some other sort of automation, if that allows you to produce things at a cheaper rate, that means that you can make more profits in the market. The process of specialization is another outcome of this. So suddenly companies and entire economies starting to specialize in what they produce so that they can be the best at it, so that they can survive in the market. And it also leads to the sabotage of competitors. It's not much talked about in terms of economic theory, but sabotage is a core part of capitalism. One of my favorite examples is Uber, when they were getting started, used to call up other cab companies and then cancel the cabs as a way to sort of block off their competitors. So sabotage, I think, is a key feature of capitalism. Now, the outcome of these competitive actions is eventually expressed in the sort of medium-term tendencies of capitalism. So prices will tangentially decline to the level of costs. This is why oftentimes goods become cheaper under capitalism. Profits across different industries tended to become more equal, so competition drives this sort of process of equalization. But ultimately, relentless growth imposes itself as the ultimate logic of capitalism. So I'd be interested to talk with Phil about this, but I think even if we have a diversity of markets, under capitalism, they are subsumed under this sort of overarching logic of accumulation. So markets are important to capitalism, but perhaps not in the way we might intuitively think. It's the social relation of market dependency that imposes systemic imperatives on economic agents. And those imperatives drive business decisions, consumer choices, and worker actions. Now, I want to talk a little bit about neoliberalism as the most recent expression of capitalist tendencies. And this has been since the 1970s, we've seen the rise of neoliberalism as a political project that has tried to gain control over the machinery of the state. Now, it has earlier precedents, most notably actually here in Germany. The immediate post-World War II reconstruction involved neoliberals trying to shape public policy and the approach to the economy. But what we see in the 1970s is neoliberalism take hold across the world. So the UK starts taking up some of its ideas. You have a crisis in the middle of the 1970s, and the UK starts taking on austerity measures, neoliberal austerity measures, as a response to that crisis. The US begins flirting with these ideas, and of course in countries like Chile, neoliberalism is viciously imposed upon them. Now the question of neoliberalism, I think, begs the sort of question of what is actually neo about it? What is novel about neoliberalism? So I think if classic liberalism saw the market and the state as something which is mutually exclusive, so under classic liberalism, if the state retreated, the market would enter in. These two things were opposed to each other, and if the state retreated, the market would automatically sort of enter in and take over. And likewise, the encroachment of the state was always an impingement upon the market. Now, I think neoliberalism differs from classic neoliberalism on this account. For neoliberalism, the market and the state are not only compatible, but actually mutually constitutive. So this is something that comes actually from Michel Foucault's work. He argues, for instance, that the market justifies the state, that economic growth and economic success come to be a sign of legitimacy for the government. But the state, at the same time, also supports and creates the market. So the market isn't something which naturally emerges. This question of who sets the prices is, I think, an absolutely essential one to thinking about how are markets actually built. One of my favorite examples is something like carbon markets. There's no necessary or natural market in carbon. And in fact, the production of carbon markets was something which took probably years and a decade or longer to produce, to get the sort of technical specifications in place, to get the technologies in place, to get the actors in place. That market had to be constructed by the state. And this is what neoliberalism has been very good at. So the primary aim of neoliberalism has been the expansion of markets since the 1970s. And we've seen this expansion of markets to new areas of life. Most notably, in the past 15 years, we have seen our personal lives increasingly monitored, recorded, and transformed into monetizable data. So we've had the spread of sensors around the world. They're all embedded in our smartphones right now. Increasingly, the environment around us is perpetuated with sensors. And this has given rise to big data. Now, this data, in turn, has been turned into a valuable asset for companies and given rise to increasingly large data markets. So we have a series of obscure companies, things like Axiom, Experian, Equifax. These companies have trillions of data points about us. Probably you've never heard of them, but they are the ones who are gathering all this data and then selling it as a market. We've also seen, though, the spatial expansion of markets with neoliberalism. So more and more of the developing world has been brought under the remit of capitalism. Maybe the biggest shock was the fall of the USSR and China's turn towards more and more capitalist reforms. And with that, we've seen that the number of proletariat, those people who are dependent upon wage labor for survival, has doubled. So with the fall of the USSR and with China entering into the capitalist world market, we saw the proletariat go from about 1.6 billion people to about 3 billion people. So a huge number of more wage laborers, of proletariats. And lastly, with neoliberalism, we've seen the expansion of markets in time. So financial markets and their massive explosion since the 1980s onwards is very much a way of marketizing the future. So that it's a way of valuing and attributing a price to future possibilities. The expansion of derivative markets in particular, with a notional value greater than the global GDP, is the marketization of the future. So I think this is what neoliberalism has been all about, is the spread of markets, and subsequently the spread of market dependency to ever more aspects of our life. So the question that arises at this point, increasingly insistently, is what do we do given the situation? So given the rapacious nature of contemporary capitalism and its insatiable spread of markets everywhere, what can be done? Now, we've seen a variety of answers throughout history. Classic one is that we bring things into collective ownership. We turn private property into collective property. But this is rather limited on its own. Ownership is not equivalent to control. And if we look at the contemporary stock market, we all, you know, if you're involved in a pension fund or anything like that, you probably are an owner of something. That doesn't mean you have any control over a company. So ownership is not sufficient, I don't think. Another answer might be that we turn towards more and more economic democracy. So to give people more and more control over areas that they typically have no control over, particularly the workplace and the production process. But I want to focus on a different approach today, which is decommodification. Now, this one has a long history as a response to the market, but I think it's been less overly prominent in recent decades. It lies at the heart of much of the social democratic project, but when sharpened, I think it takes on elements of the socialist project. So what is decommodification then? Now, the famous theorist of the welfare state, Gösta Esping Andersson, defines it this way. Decommodification occurs when a service is rendered as a matter of right, and when a person can maintain a livelihood without reliance on a market. So in other words, it occurs when a basic service, something like healthcare, something like education, is provided through the government, provided for free, rather than being purchased in the market. It also occurs when people are no longer dependent upon selling their labor power in the market to survive, when market dependency has been negated. Now, the welfare state, in various ways and with various degrees of success, has attempted to decommodify parts of society. This has been the sort of overall aim of the welfare state and of social democracy more broadly. So these can range from very partial programs aimed at helping the poorest in society, but they're also the universal programs, universal healthcare, universal pensions, these sorts of things, which are given to all members of society. These are efforts to decommodify parts of our world. But I think that the logic of decommodification, when it's taken seriously, goes far beyond what the welfare state has been able to offer. Now, to see why, I think we need to distinguish between some different types of markets. So roughly, for instance, we can distinguish between markets for goods and services, markets for money and financial products, and also markets for labor. Now, it's the latter which I think is crucial here. The decommodification of labor, or the removal of the necessity of having to sell our labor power in order to survive. So this brings me to decommodifying labor. And I think, implicitly, it's what unites a wide section of the left today. So if we talk about proponents of universal basic income, that's an attempt to decommodify labor. If we look at alternative models of social reproduction, that's an attempt to decommodify labor. If we look at anarchist anti-work struggles, or if we look at fully automated luxury communism, these are all attempts to decommodify labor. And so I think this is an increasingly prominent part of the left, even if it hasn't quite been recognized as such so far. Now, I think the rise of the decommodification of labor as a project has a good materialist explanation. It responds to the structural changes in contemporary capitalism, and it gestures towards a strategic path that implicitly responds to these changes. So we have seen since the 1960s, the high point of the mixed economy, the high point of social democracy, we've seen the global resurgence of surplus populations. This is a group of people who are increasingly surplus to capitalism's needs. People who can't find a job, people who are left in informal markets, people who are eking out an existence on the edges of capitalism. So we've seen a trend line for unemployment to go higher and higher and higher every decade since the 1960s. And in the poor world, we've seen the massive growth of informal labor markets. So billions of people now working in these things, eking out an existence at the edge. So as Joan Robinson once wrote, the misery of being exploited by capitalists is nothing compared to the misery of not being exploited at all. So it's this condition. I think the breakdown of the wage-labor relationship, the rise of surplus populations, which defines much of contemporary capitalism. And I think it's under these circumstances that it's no surprise that a growing number of movements are implicitly tackling the decommodification of labor. Now, I want to conclude by arguing that if we're going to fight the encroachment of markets and the ruinous stagnation of capitalism, we should make the decommodification of labor an explicit goal, not just an implicit one, but an explicit goal of our political projects. Now, there's a long tradition of a moralistic line of thought which argues for the decommodification of labor on the basis of labor's moral value. So we can think about some of early Marx's work would fall into this, some of the humanism there. You've got this idea of the alienation of the capitalist work processes being set against the free creativity and productivity of the human individual. Karl Polanyi's work would also align with this. So labor for him is fundamentally antagonistic to commodification. There's always going to be some sort of resistance there. But the point in either case there is that decommodification is important because of the moral value of human individuals. Now, I don't really care about the moral value. I'm more interested in the strategic reasons why we should take on decommodified labor as a project. And I think the decommodification of labor is structurally more radical than the decommodification of other markets. I think it's more of a non-reformist reform than, for example, something like social housing or universal healthcare. So I think we've seen that the latter are entirely compatible with capitalism. We can decommodify these basic services, and we can have them provided to us. They aren't a threat to capitalism. The decommodification of labor, on the other hand, would mean the breakdown of the imperatives which force workers into the labor market and which provide the lifeblood of the capitalist system. It would be an attack right on the generalized market dependency that is essential to that social relationship that guides capitalism. So I think by freeing us from the labor market, it would mean workers are no longer subject to the imperative to sell their labor power. It would transform the labor market into one from one defined by the scarcity of jobs into a labor market defined by the power and scarcity of workers. And I think it would mean a complete reversal of the power between workers and capital. So for all these reasons, I think that if we want to combat markets, if we think that capitalism is not as good as we can do, that if we can do something better, we should aim for the decommodification of labor as a non-reformist reform. Thank you.